Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Sabbath as Resistance, Saying No to the Culture of Now, by Walter Brueggemann, narrated by Adam Werner. Preface. For the most part, contemporary Christians pay little attention to the Sabbath. We more or less know that the day came to reflect in U.S. culture the most stringent disciplinary faith of the Puritans, which in recent time translated into a moralistic prescription for a day of quiet restraint and prohibition. In many somewhat pietistic homes, that amounted to not playing cards or seeing films on Sunday, and certainly not shopping. I can remember each year debates in our rural community about farmers working on some few Sundays to harvest wheat in the face of devastating rains that were sure to come. I can remember from my earlier days, moreover, that because of blue laws, Sunday home baseball games for the Phillies and the Pirates in Pennsylvania could not begin a new inning after 6 p.m. The sum of all these memories of restraint was essentially negative, a series of thou shalt nots that served to echo the more fundamental prohibitions of the Decalogue. This context did not offer much potential for seeing the Sabbath in a positive way, as an affirmative declaration of faith or identity. And, of course, as church monopoly and our culture has in many places waned or disappeared, the commitment to Sabbath discipline has likewise receded. As in so many things concerning Christian faith and practice, we have to be re-educated by Judaism that has been able to sustain its commitment to Sabbath as a positive practice of faith. The magisterial book of Abraham Heschel continues to be a lead voice in the Jewish awareness of Sabbath. In our present context, perhaps it is Michael Fishbane's eloquent probe of Jewish practices that has the most to teach us about Jewish understandings of Sabbath. Fishbane's discussion is in the larger context of his splendid book concerning the maintenance of Jewish mindfulness in a society that is increasingly mindless. The Sabbath, along with the other practices he exposits, concerns the maintenance of a distinct faith identity in the midst of a culture that is inhospitable to all distinct identities in its impatient reduction of all human life to the requirements of the market. In contrast, and contradiction to cultural mindlessness, that can hardly be underestimated. The Sabbath and its observance may cultivate a theological mindfulness. How so? The Sabbath sanctifies time through sanctioned forms of rest and inaction. On this day, certain workaday activities and ordinary busyness are suspended and brought to a halt. In their stead, a whole host of ways of resting the body and mind are cultivated. These are of a special cultural type, for though we have a natural notion of work and think of it in terms of physical exertion or compulsory performance, done in order to sustain one's livelihood, these kinds of labor relate to our Adamic selves, the physical self that is sent forth into the world and must work the earth to provide sustenance, while losing body strength on one's life course toward death. By contrast, our Mosaic selves are enhanced through the teachings of the Oral Torah, which bring together notions of work and categories of labor to bear. Fishbane contrasts the Adamic self, the one of natural creatureliness, with the Mosaic self that comes under the sway of the Mosaic commands of Sinai. The Sabbath is a sphere of inaction. One enters the sphere of inaction through divestment, and this release affects all the elements of the workaday sphere. Business activity and exchange of money are forbidden, and one is urged not just to desist from commerce, but to develop more interior spheres of settling the mind from this type of agitation. Slowly, under these multiple conditions, a sense of inaction takes over, and the day does not merely mark the stoppage of work or celebrate the completion of creation, but enforces the value that the earth is a gift of divine creativity, given to humankind in sacred trust. On the Sabbath, the practical benefits of technology are laid aside, and one tries to stand in the cycle of natural time, without manipulation or interference. To the degree possible, one must attempt to bring the qualities of inaction and rest into the heart and mind. The Sabbath is thus a period of sacred stasis, a duration of sanctity, through the cultivation of inaction in body and spirit. The heartbeat of repose may thus suffuse the mind and limbs of one's being, and generate an inner balance poised on quietude and a settled spirit. The choice of an economic image by Fishbane, divestment, suggests that we may consider the Sabbath as an alternative to the endless demands of economic reality, more specifically, the demands of market ideology that depend, as Adam Smith had already seen, on the generation of needs and desires that will leave us endlessly restless, inadequate, unfulfilled, and in pursuit of that which may satiate desire. Those requirements concern endless predation, so that we are a society of 24/7 multitasking in order to achieve, accomplish, perform, and possess. But the demands of market ideology pertain as much to consumption as they do to production. Thus, the system of commodity requires that we want more, have more, own more, use more, eat more, and drink more. The rat race of such predation and usurpation is a restlessness that issues inescapably in anxiety, that is often at the edge of being unmanageable. When pursued vigorously enough, moreover, one is propelled to violence against the neighbor in eagerness for what properly belongs to the neighbor. As acute as this is for us in our society, this is not an unprecedented or even new situation. It is, as Judaism remembers, as old as Pharaoh's insatiable script for production. It is impossible to imagine that in the system of Pharaoh there could ever be any restfulness for anyone. Refer to Exodus chapter 5, verses 4 through 19. Most remarkably, Israel, in the narrative, finally is delivered from Pharaoh's anxiety system and comes to the wilderness. There Israel is given bread that is not permitted to store up. Exodus chapter 16, verses 13 through 21. But even more remarkable, even in such a marginal context, with daily need for bread that is given for the day, provision is made for the Sabbath. Israel cannot store up bread for more than a day, except, big except, on the sixth day, Israel may store up enough for the seventh day, so that it can rest on that day. Verses 22 through 24. This unexpected provision is surely a sign that this bread for life is not under the demanding governance of Pharaoh. It is under the sustaining rule of the Creator God. Even in the wilderness, with scarce resources, God mandates a pause for Sabbath for the community. Eat it today, for today is a Sabbath to the Lord. Today you will not find it in the field. 6 days you shall gather it, but on the seventh day, which is a Sabbath, there will be none. On the seventh day, some of the people went out to gather, and they found none. The Lord said to Moses, "How long will you refuse to keep my commandments and instructions? See, the Lord has given you the Sabbath. Therefore, on the sixth day, he gives you food for 2 days. Each of you stay where you are. Do not leave your place on the seventh day." So the people rested on the seventh day. Verses 25 through 30. The conclusion affirmed by the narrative is that wherever Yahweh governs as an alternative to Pharaoh, there the restfulness of Yahweh effectively counters the restless anxiety of Pharaoh. In our own contemporary context of the rat race of anxiety, the celebration of Sabbath is an act of both resistance and alternative. It is resistance because it is a visible insistence that our lives are not defined by the production and consumption of commodity goods. Such an act of resistance requires enormous intentionality and communal reinforcement amid the barrage of seductive pressures from the insatiable insistences of the market, with its intrusion into every part of our life, from the family to the national budget. In our anxious society, to cite a case in point, one of the great seductions of Pharaoh is the fact that soccer practice invades the rest day. Families largely contained in market ideology think of themselves as helpless before the requirements of such commitment. In context, it requires, or would require, subjunctive, contrary to fact, enormous communal resolve to resist the demand. But Sabbath is not only resistance. It is alternative. It is an alternative to the demanding, chattering, pervasive presence of advertising and its great liturgical claim of professional sports that devour all our rest time. The alternative on offer is the awareness and practice of the claim that we are situated on the receiving end of the gifts of God. To be situated is a staggering option, because we are accustomed to being on the initiating end of all things. We neither expect nor even want a gift to be given, so inured are we to accomplishing and achieving and possessing. Thus, I have come to think that the fourth commandment on Sabbath is the most difficult and most urgent of the commandments in our society, because it summons us to intent and conduct that defies the most elemental requirements of a commodity-propelled society that specializes in control and entertainment, bread and circuses, along with anxiety and violence. I have taken as a theme for this little book a familiar phrase from the teaching of Jesus in Matthew chapter 11. There, he contrasts the heavy yoke of his contemporary society with his easy yoke, verses 29 through 30. That heavy yoke about which his listeners knew perhaps refers to the imposition of Rome and the demanding taxation of the empire, an endless tax to support military adventurism. It is equally possible that the yoke refers to the stringent requirements of establishment religion, in which many could not qualify. Either way, empire or religion that colludes with empire, the requirements of acquiescent conduct were heavy. And Jesus, who resisted such a yoke, offered an alternative life of discipleship. Thus in our text, discipleship may concern the love of God and the love of neighbor, practices readily alternative to making it in the economic world of command performance. And now, in the utterance of Jesus and in the practice of Jesus and his community, gifts are given. The gifts that are given lie outside the domain of empire and its colluding symbol systems. By appealing to Jesus, I do not suggest Christian preemption of this defining Jewish observance. Rather, Jesus fully understood and commended the practice of his Jewish inheritance, which invites to restfulness. This book is addressed exactly to those who are weary and heavy laden, made so by the insatiable requirements of our society, in its taxation for the sake of imperialism, in its social conformity that urges doing more and having more, now perniciously embodied in teaching to test, in its frightened intent that there should be no free lunch for anyone, in its assumption that there is a technological resolution of every human problem, in its pathologies of greed and control. I am glad to thank David Maxwell, who first invited me to write on Sabbath for his enterprise, The Thoughtful Christian. I am equally grateful to Marianne Blickenstaff for her readiness to move from that initial publication with David to what is offered here. And I am pleased that the press has now added a study guide. I anticipate that such a study guide will give many listeners better access to the issues to be faced concerning Sabbath. I am most grateful for the work of Martha Bettis Gee, who has prepared the study guide. She has engaged the material in a most thoughtful way that will be of great benefit to listeners of the study as they pursue these urgent issues. I have found this study to be an important existential one for me. I know about the restless anxiety of not yet having done enough. I am glad to dedicate this book to the memory of my mother, Hilda, who knew more about work than about rest. Charles was her firstborn, who died young, in his second year before I was born. I learned more about a work ethic from my mother than I did about rest. But my growing up was plain and simple, close to the soil. There was in our home a natural restfulness imposed by the measures of rural life and my father's blessed garden. My mother would readily interrupt her Sabbath rest for the sake of any of her sons, most especially for Charles, whose precarious life required such attentiveness that she willingly gave. I have come to think that the moment of giving the bread of Eucharist as gift is the quintessential center of the notion of Sabbath rest in Christian tradition. It is gift. We receive in gratitude. Imagine having a sacrament named thanks. We are on the receiving end without accomplishment, achievement, or qualification. It is a gift, and we are grateful. That moment of gift is a peaceable alternative that many who are weary and heavy laden, cumbered with a load of care, receive gladly. The offer of free gift, faithful to Judaism, might let us learn enough to halt the dramatic anti-neighborliness to which our society is madly and uncritically committed. Fishbane concludes concerning the Lord of Peace. This is dying within life for love of God. It is a divestment of will for God's sake and the wonder of the world. Walter Brueggemann, Columbia Theological Seminary. Chapter 1. Sabbath and the First Commandment. Interpretation Series editor Patrick Miller has shrewdly observed that the Fourth Commandment on Sabbath is the crucial bridge that connects the Ten Commandments together. The Fourth Commandment looks back to the first three commandments and the God who rests, Exodus chapter 20, verses 3 through 7. At the same time, the Sabbath commandment looks forward to the last six commandments that concern the neighbor, verses 12 through 17. They provide for rest alongside the neighbor. God, self, and all members of the household share in common rest on the seventh day. That social reality provides a commonality and a coherence not only to the community of covenant, but to the commandments of Sinai as well. For that reason, it is appropriate in our study of the Sabbath commandment to begin with a reflection on the first commandment, and subsequently, to finish our work with a consideration of the tenth commandment that concludes the Decalogue. The first commandments concern God, God's aniconic character, and God's name. Exodus chapter 20, verses 3 through 7. But when we consider the identity of this God, we are made immediately aware that the God who will brook no rival, and who eventually will rest, is a God who is embedded in a narrative. This God is not known or available apart from that narrative. The narrative matrix of Yahweh, the God of Israel, is the Exodus narrative. This is the God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. Verse 2. Thus the Sabbath commandment is drawn into the Exodus narrative, for the God who rests is the God who emancipates from slavery, and consequently from the work system of Egypt and from the gods of Egypt, who require and legitimate that work system. It is, for that reason, fair to judge that the prohibition against the other gods in the first commandment pertains directly to the gods of Egypt. Refer to Exodus chapter 12, verse 12, and other gods of the same ilk in Canaan, or subsequently the gods of the great empires of Assyria, Babylon, or Persia. In the narrative imagination of Israel, the gods of Egypt are stand-ins for all the gods of the several empires. What they all have in common is that they are confiscatory gods who demand endless produce and who authorize endless systems of production that are, in principle, insatiable. Thus, the mention of Egypt brings the God of Israel into the orbit of socio-economic systems and practices, and inevitably sets this God on a collision course with the gods of insatiable productivity. The reference to Egypt indicates that the God of Sinai, who gives the Ten Commandments, is never simply a religious figure, but is always preoccupied with and attentive to socio-economic practice and policy. If we want, then, to understand this God, or any God, we must look to the socio-economic system that God legitimates and authorizes. In the case of the Egyptian gods, who are in contrast to and in competition with the God of the Exodus, we look to Pharaoh's system of production that is legitimated by the gods worshipped by Pharaoh. In Exodus chapter 5, we are given a passionate narrative account of the labor system in which Pharaoh endlessly demands more production. What the slaves are to produce is more bricks that are to be used for the building of more supply cities, in which Pharaoh can store his endless supply of material wealth in the form of grain. Refer to Exodus chapter 1, verse 11. Because the system was designed to produce more and more surplus, refer to Genesis chapter 47, verses 13 through 26, there was always more need for storage units that in turn generated more need for bricks with which to construct them. Thus, if we follow the required bricks from the slave camps, we end with surplus wealth. taken as a gift of the gods of Pharaoh. In this narrative report, Pharaoh is a hard-nosed production manager for whom production schedules are inexhaustible. Why are you taking the people away from their work? Get to your labors. Exodus chapter 5, verse 4. Yet you want them to stop working. Verse 5. You shall no longer give the people straw to make bricks as before. Let them go and gather straw for themselves. But you shall require of them the same quantity of bricks as they have made previously. Do not diminish it, for they are lazy. Verses 7 through 8. Let heavier work be laid on them. Then they will labor at it, and pay no attention to deceptive words. Verse 9. I will not give you straw. Go and get straw yourselves, wherever you can find it. But your work will not be lessened in the least. Verses 10 through 11. Complete your work the same daily assignment as when you were given straw. Verse 13. Why did you not finish the required quantity of bricks yesterday and today, as you did before? Verse 14. No straw is given to your servants, yet they say to us, make bricks. Verse 16. You are lazy, lazy. That is why you say, let us go and sacrifice to the Lord. Go now and work, for no straw will be given you, but you shall still deliver the same number of bricks. Verses 17 through 19. You shall not lessen your daily number of bricks. Verse 19. The rhetoric is relentless, all to the single point, as relentless as is the production schedule. It is clear that in this system there can be no Sabbath rest. There is no rest for Pharaoh in his supervisory capacity, and he undoubtedly monitors daily production schedules. Consequently, there can be no rest for Pharaoh's supervisors or taskmasters, and of course there can be no rest for the slaves, who must satisfy the taskmasters in order to meet Pharaoh's demanding quotas. We may imagine, moreover, that the Egyptian gods also never rested, because of their commitment to the aggrandizement of Pharaoh's system. For the glory of Pharaoh surely redounded to the glory of the Egyptian gods. The economy reflects the splendor of the gods who legitimate the entire system, for which cheap labor is an indispensable footnote. It requires no imagination to see that the Exodus memory, and consequently the Sinai commandments, are performed in a no-Sabbath environment. In that context, all levels of social power, gods, Pharaoh, supervisors, taskmasters, slaves, are uniformly caught up in and committed to the grind of endless production. Into this system of hopeless weariness erupts the God of the burning bush. Exodus chapter 3, verses 1 through 6. That God heard the despairing fatigue of the slaves, chapter 2, verses 23 through 25, resolved to liberate the slave company of Israel from that exploitative system, chapter 3, verses 7 through 9, and recruited Moses for the human task of emancipation, chapter 3, verse 10. The reason Miriam and the other women can sing and dance at the end of the Exodus narrative is the emergence of a new social reality, in which the life of the Israelite economy is no longer determined and compelled by the insatiable production quotas of Egypt and its gods. Chapter 15, verses 20 through 21. The first commandment is a declaration that the God of the Exodus is unlike all the gods the slaves have known heretofore. This God is not to be confused with or thought parallel to the insatiable gods of imperial productivity. This God is subsequently revealed as a God of mercy, steadfast love, and faithfulness, who is committed to covenantal relationships of fidelity. Refer to Exodus chapter 34, verses 6 through 7. At the taproot of this divine commitment to relationship, covenant, rather than commodity, bricks, is the capacity and willingness of this God to rest. The Sabbath rest of God is the acknowledgement that God and God's people in the world are not commodities to be dispatched for endless production, and so dispatched, as we used to say, as hands in the service of a command economy. Rather, they are subjects situated in an economy of neighborliness. All of that is implicit in the reality and exhibit of divine rest. Thus, the Sabbath command of Exodus chapter 20, verse 11, recalls that God rested on the seventh day of creation, an allusion to Genesis chapter 2, verses 1 through 4. that divine rest on the seventh day of creation has made clear, A, that Yahweh is not a workaholic, B, that Yahweh is not anxious about the full functioning of creation, and C, that the well-being of creation does not depend on endless work. This performance and exhibit of divine rest thus characterize the God of creation, creation itself, and the creatures made in the image of the resting God. Creation is to be enacted and embraced without defining anxiety. Indeed, such divine rest serves to delegitimate and dismantle the endless restlessness sanctioned by the other gods and enacted by their adherents. That divine rest on the seventh day, moreover, is recalled in the commandment of Exodus chapter 31, verses 12 through 17, wherein God is refreshed on the seventh day. The God of Israel and of creation is no immovable fixed object, but here is said to be depleted and by rest may recover a full sense of self, nefesh. The second commandment is closely related to the first. The commandment against graven images, idols, is a prohibition against any artistic representation of Yahweh, for such representation would serve to locate Yahweh, to domesticate God, and so to curb the freedom that belongs to this erupting God. Exodus chapter 20, verses 4 through 6. See 2 Samuel chapter 7, verses 6 through 7. Such images have the effect of drawing God, in imagination and in practice, away from covenantal relational fidelity and back into a world of objects and commodities. The temptation to produce an image of God in artistic form is always, everywhere, a chance to produce a commodity out of valuable material, at best gold if it is available, or lesser valuable material if there is no gold. When a god is fashioned into a golden commodity, or even lesser material, divine subject becomes divine object, an agent becomes commodity. We may cite two obvious examples of this temptation in the Old Testament. First, in the narrative of the golden calf, in Exodus chapter 32, it was gold that was fashioned into the image that readily became an alternative god, who jeopardized the covenant. The ensuing narrative of Exodus chapters 33 through 34 tells of the hard and tricky negotiations whereby covenantal possibility is restored to Israel after its foray into distorting images. Exodus chapter 34, verses 9 through 10. Less dramatically, it is evident that Solomon's temple, designed to house Yahweh, became a commodity enterprise preoccupied with gold. The interior of the inner sanctuary was 20 cubits long, 20 cubits wide, and 20 cubits high. He overlaid it with pure gold. He also overlaid the altar with cedar. Solomon overlaid the inside of the house with pure gold. Then he drew chains of gold across in front of the inner sanctuary, and overlaid it with gold. Next he overlaid the whole house with gold, in order that the whole house might be perfect. Even the whole altar that belonged to the inner sanctuary, he overlaid with gold. 1 Kings chapter 6, verses 20 through 22. So Solomon made all the vessels that were in the house of the Lord, the golden altar, the golden table for the bread of the presence, the lampstands of pure gold, 5 on the south side and 5 on the north, in front of the inner sanctuary, the flowers, the lamps, and the tongs of gold, the cups, snuffers, basins, dishes for incense, and fire pans of pure gold, the sockets for the doors of the innermost part of the house, the most holy place, and for the doors of the nave of the temple of gold. Chapter 7, verses 48 through 50. Even as Yahweh was honored by such extravagance, the temple was clearly intended to reflect honor on Solomon and on his regime. The attention to gold objects clearly skewed the simple and direct matter of covenantal possibility. Commodity desire has, for the most part, crowded out the covenantal tradition. In the modern world, Karl Marx reflected most deeply on the compelling power of commodity. He took his famous phrase, commodity fetishism, from a current study of the history of religions, in which it was judged that primitives had such fetishes that occupied their desire and their devotion. Marx transferred that idea from primitive practice to modern market fascination, and came to see that possessing commodities of social value generated a desire for more such value, so that commodity took on a power of its own that consisted of desire for more and more. It is easy enough to see Pharaoh's compulsion for more grain, a measure.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?